It's basically a story told by someone in Mexico, believed to be a Mayan myth, maybe Aztec. I will, as I go along, catch some of the sexism in the story, and some of it I won't, because it'll get by me too fast. They were only four in number, the gods in heaven. Each one sat on a chair and rested, for the earth had already been made, just as we see it now, its lap heaped high with bounty. The ocean had already been made, before which everyone who sees it trembles. The wind had already been made to be the guardian over all things. But people were not yet made. Then one of the four gods, the one dressed in yellow. It's interesting to me that in Mexican mythology and religious symbol systems that the colors, that the gods and everything comes in colors. That's a little different than I'm accustomed to. Then one of the four gods, the one dressed in yellow, said, "We'll make people, or we'll make man, so that he may know us and his heart may be consumed with gratitude, like a grain of incense." The other three agreed with a nod and went to look for molds with which to work. "What shall we make people of?" they said. And the one who was dressed in yellow took a lump of mud and with his fingers drew in the face and the arms and the legs. The other three watched and gave their consent. But when the little clay person was finished and was put to the test of water, he crumbled away. "Let us make people of wood," said the one dressed in red. The others agreed. So the one who was dressed in red lopped off a branch and with the blade of a knife marked the features in. When the wooden person was made, was put to the test of water, and the limbs floated. They didn't fall to pieces, and the features were not rubbed out. The four gods were satisfied, but when the mannequin was put to the test of fire, he began to crackle and lose his shape. The four gods spent a whole night in parley, till one of them, the one who was dressed in black, said, "My advice is that we make a person of gold." And the god untied the gold he kept knotted in his handkerchief, and between the four of them, they modeled the person of gold. One pulled out his nose, another stuck in the teeth, another drew the snail shell of his ears. When the golden person was finished, they tested him in water and in fire, and the golden person came out even more beautiful and resplendent than before. Then the four gods looked at one another, satisfied, and they set the gold person on the ground and waited, hoping he would recognize them and give them praise. But the gold person did not move, did not even blink, was quite silent, and his heart was like the stone of the sapodilla, very hard and dry. Then three of the four lords asked the one who had not yet given his opinion, "What shall we make people of?" And this last one, who was dressed neither in yellow, nor red, nor in black, for this god wore a garment that had no color at all, said, "Let's make people out of flesh." And with his machete, he cut off the fingers of his left hand. And the fingers jumped into the air and fell into the midst of things and never suffered the tests of fire and water. Obviously, there's a theological problem here. You know, if the person of clay doesn't make it because of water and the person of wood doesn't make it because of fire, then what do you do with flesh, which isn't going to make it very well in either water or fire? But they just kind of, you know, blick around it, which is what generally happens theologically. The four gods could scarcely make out what the people of flesh looked like because the distance had shrunk them to the size of ants. The effort they made to see the people of flesh inflamed the four gods' eyes, and with so much rubbing of them, they grew drowsy. The one with the yellow robe yawned, and his yawn opened the mouths of the other three, and they fell asleep, for they were tired and old. In the meantime, on earth, the people of flesh scurried to and fro like ants. They had already learned which fruit is good to eat, with what big leaves they could protect themselves from the rain, and which animals don't bite, obviously, the necessities of life here. One day they were astonished to see, standing in front of them, the person of gold. His glitter struck them between the eyes, and when they touched him, their hands turned cold as if they had touched a snake. They stood there waiting for the person of gold to speak. The time came to eat, and the people of flesh gave the person of gold a morsel. The time came to go away, and the people of flesh carried the person of gold with them. And day by day, the hardness of the heart of the person of gold was softened, until the word of gratitude the four gods had placed within him rose to his lips. The lords woke up to hear their names pronounced among the psalms of praise, and they looked to see what had happened on earth while they were sleeping, and they approved what they saw. And from that moment they called the person of gold rich and the people of flesh poor. And they ordered things in such a way that the rich person should care for the poor and shelter them, since it was the rich person who benefited by the poor people's acts. And the gods so ordered it that the poor should answer for the rich before the face of truth. That is why our law says that no rich person can enter heaven if a poor person does not lead him by the hand. That's again sort of like a camel in the eye of the needle sort of thing. Can rich people go to heaven? Probably not, if there's a heaven. Unless they are led by the poor, unless they somehow can justify their existence before the depths of human suffering. It's a funny thing, you know, there's a lot of powerful scriptural stuff to that effect, the Lazarus story and so forth, but American culture manages to gloss it, to rationalize it, to find ways to make it sound like a reflection of American culture. And that's because, basically, for most of us, I think in the church, American culture kind of sets the reference group from within which we make sense out of reality and interpret what's going on. In Up From Apathy, there are two categories that are talked about briefly. One is role models, and one is reference groups. And we listed some role models the other night, or morning, whichever time it was. People that were saints of social justice to us. People who we saw as role models. But we didn't go on to talk about, nor did I mention at that time, reference groups. What do I mean by reference groups? It's a sociological concept, but by reference groups, I mean, and I think this is true of each of us, the people in terms of whom we judge our own identity. The people in terms of whom we decide how we're doing. Like who? Well, it would be different for each of you, I think. when I was had a mission in Maine, an ALC mission in Maine, and it was like not making it very well. In fact, it took that church 25 years to become self-sufficient because it was just not a growth area. It's just for Lutherans, it just was not a growth area. In fact, 25 years after I left there at the end of 3 years, and 22 years later, they only had a few more members. Military base there, a lot of turnover. You know, people come in, people go out. It stayed even, but it didn't gain a whole lot ever. Still hasn't. Gained a little bit, but not a whole lot. When I would go, I would be, you know, as a mission pastor, I would be invited to go to mission conferences with the clergy who were also involved in establishing missions. So I'd go to this mission conference, people that were doing these missions, and here would be someone from Long Island. Somehow that one stuck in my head. And, you know, a year after they had opened that church, they had paid back their debt and bought a large property, and they had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of members, and I was struggling along with 30 and then 40 and then 50. My reference group, the group in terms of which I defined myself, was these people who were, quote, doing better than I was. And then one day I realized that, hey, I was buying into American culture, you know? That I was measuring myself the same way you'd measure yourself if you sold widgets. I was measuring myself by the next higher group. I think a lot of our, in American culture, a lot of our frustration with people usually comes to the people who are just above us, rather than the people that are way up there, that are way outside of our reality in terms of money or things like that. When I taught in seminary, the reference group became, it's very interesting, I think. I think a whole institution can be defined sometimes by its reference group. It was a seminary in a university context. The seminary became defined by the university so that salaries, standards, promotion and tenure, sabbaticals, all of those kinds of things were defined by university standards so that we began to understand ourselves in terms of a success model defined by the American Academy of Religion or by university seminaries. And it was really very refreshing. I spent a weekend at the Lutheran Seminary in Philadelphia. And it was very refreshing to see. They had a whole different way of looking at least that was my impression in that weekend, a whole different way of looking at things. For example, let me give a very specific example. In the seminaries that I was kind of hanging around, your promotion was strictly a question of publication. If you published not at all, you didn't get tenure. If you published some, one book, a couple of articles, you probably get tenure. Though as the years went on, you had to produce more and more just to get that. Then if you produced several books, if you produced two books and a bunch of articles, then you made maybe full professor, two or three books, something like that. And as long as they weren't self-published, that didn't count. Well, I went to Philadelphia and was talking to some of the faculty there, and it turned out that they had somebody teaching one of the fields there who was into music, seriously into music, and would take students to concerts, and who headed the music life of that seminary. And he didn't publish, apparently. I mean, I never saw his resume, but I gathered from what they said he published little or not at all. Nonetheless, his contribution to that seminary in the area of music was viewed to be of equivalent value to the contribution made by another member of the faculty who published and published and published and published. That is to say, there was not one kind of univocal success ladder on which all people had to get in order to define their worth and to let their worth be defined by the institution. So the reference group of a university seminary, it seemed to me, began to be the university and the academy professionally. And you defined how you were doing in terms of your measurement in the academy. It's very clear in school, I mean, it's grades. It's very clear in military service, it's rank. It's very clear in a lot of administrative and business settings where there's, you know, the president, the vice presidents, and so forth, the whole hierarchy. And people define how they're doing in terms of how they're progressing up that ladder. Reference groups, however, can be not only professional, but they can be personal. I'm sure that people who do skateboarding or people that do sailboarding define themselves, how they're doing, in terms of whoever the experts at sailboarding or skateboarding are. They have these role models, these people, and you define how you're doing relative to how these other people are doing. And I think that's probably universally true, that we tend to define ourselves in certain ways. It's very hard to define yourself in terms of the Christian message as long as you're a part of American culture. And yet we can't escape American culture. I think that, how do you, you know, I keep listening and I keep trying to figure out what's going on. Like at the service last night, I was touched by things that were said. And as soon as that happens, I step back one step and say, what in me was touched? Why was I touched? Why are people responding to this? I try to read the culture by the way people respond to what's going on in the setting, with greater or lesser degree of success. And since I'm a clone of the culture, very often if I just look inside myself, I can figure out why other people are responding very much the same way. Another way of trying to get handles on the culture is to look at magazines. I was, about a year ago or so, I took three magazines, the New York Times Magazine, People Magazine, and Parade Magazine. And I just looked at, here's three different magazines that are kind of aimed at somewhat different audiences, although Parade and People are fairly close. And I looked at the ads in them. I figure that the people that know more about us than anybody else are not the sociologists necessarily, or the cultural anthropologists, or the theologians, or the ethicists. The people that know most about us are the people that are selling us things. They are the people that invest billions of dollars in trying to get inside our heads, so that they can see what'll hook us, what can they make a profit off of, and an enormous, brilliant, creative talent. The people that do this stuff at the top levels are brilliant people. And so there's an enormous amount of money, an enormous amount of intelligence and creativity goes into this stuff. Well, so in the New York Times, you're invited to have an imaginary drink of an Italian liqueur, and you suddenly find yourself standing by the Tivoli Fountain in Rome. That appeals to a certain kind of class interest, you know. If you drink this Italian liqueur, you will be, it's like standing next to, it's like being in Rome. In People magazine, you find yourself sipping Seagram's 7 and playing 8-ball. You've notched down here just a little bit, you know, it's kind of the fun crowd. Also in People, you look at the Crown Royal ad, Crown Royal Scotch ad. This is great. These people have gotten more mileage out of me, more publicity out of me than they probably got in the newspaper. But I just think this is just a wonderful little piece. This is the Crown Royal ad. Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his Crown Royal, and now Jill is dating some guy from L.A. I guess, is that great or is that great? That's marvelous. But the message is, if you want to date the right people, you have to have the right whiskey. Okay. The adjectives that jumped out of the Times ads to lure us were, it's classic, it suits your style, it's impressive. What is impressive? It means that people will be impressed by you if you wear this. an ad for furs brags, more is more. None of this more is less stuff. We are now, if you're buying furs, if you're at that level, we're into the more is more crowd. The ad goes on. More exclusive personal service. More professional and creative expertise. More selection of premier quality furs. More exquisite fashion. And so forth. It says, you can buy limited edition cashmere socks. Now, what does that mean? Now, they're probably wonderful, okay? I'm not putting the product down. They're probably wonderful. But what does limited edition mean? Limited edition means, what makes it limited? Only a few people relatively can afford it, you know? You know, it has nothing to do with anything. You know, you can feel distinctive because you're not wearing mass-produced socks. Here's another ad. This woman in the ad says, in his furs, his is the name of some guy who has this fur company, you know, whoever he is. In his furs, I feel luxurious, sensual, dramatic, and individually me. Individually me. Yeah, I mean, you buy it off a hanger, right? Somewhere. Sensual. If you want your lady friend to feel sensual, you will give her the... I mean, the message is in there. The messages in there are loud and clear. I feel luxurious, sensual, dramatic, and individually me. Who has it said, I've been rich and I've been poor and richer is better? It's probably true. In this particular issue of the Times, there was an article about the pleasures. This was funny. There was an article about the pleasure of giving at Christmas. Okay. But what they have in mind here is not making cookies and taking them next door to the neighbor. There are ads for purses around $400, shoes around $400, a clutch bag for $1,050, a robe for $1,600. Now bear in mind that $250 is the average annual per capita income of the poorest people on our globe. $250, less than the price of a pair of shoes. What sort of spiritual center is there in a culture where people will trade a pair of shoes for a person's life, a person's well-being, a person's... health. A full page color ad shows an attractive young couple sipping wine at a small table with a white tablecloth on a red tiled Spanish balcony. To the left you can see rolling hills and distant mountains. I think paradise is a very secular place. A lot of Americans say they believe in heaven. I don't think they really do until they die or till somebody dies. I think that for most Americans, they say it as an intellectual statement, as a statement of belief, but as an emotional statement, I think most Americans don't really believe in heaven, because if they did, they wouldn't be trying so hard to get it all in this life. I think that a lot of American culture is driven by the fear of death and the desire to grab it, get it. You know, and you see those bumper stickers, you know, the one that has the most toys wins. And I watch bumper stickers a lot because they tell me something about what people are thinking and feeling. So what are the myths, rites, and symbols of American culture? One of the major myths of American culture is the Horatio Alger myth. You can succeed if you try hard enough. And the corollary is that if you fail, it's a moral defect. You have a passion for excellence. Nothing succeeds like success. You know, what is best? What does best mean in all of those contexts? Does it mean a good environment? Does it mean good education? No, it usually means the ability to command greater number of resources. And you know, I know here that none of you are into this, and therefore, it's not like I'm preaching at you or anything, because obviously Holden is a place apart from those kinds of things. And your lifestyles, I'm sure, are not those kind of lifestyles. But, you know, a passion for excellence. You mean like excellence of health care for poor people? Uh-uh, no way in American culture. The passion for excellence is to beat out the next person, to be on top, to win. We're number one. You know, that's what football teams say, baseball teams. We're the biggest, we're the best. Cheerleaders shout it. Hamburger havens hustle it. Car rental agencies advertise it. Surgeons charge for it. The Pentagon predicates its budget in being number one in tanks, number one in planes, number one in ships, number one in troops, number one in machine guns. You got to be number one in every category of military hardware and personnel to somehow win out over the enemy. Well, for every number one, there's a number two and a number three and a number four. Most of us are numbers twos, threes, fours, and tens, and 25s. And that's why Rodney Dangerfield strikes a responsive chord with "I don't get no respect." And Woody Allen with his klutzing through life and sort of winning in spite of himself. The winners are Rocky, Indiana Jones, Batman, people like that. And those are the ones that are pulling in clearly, you know. What was the thing I saw? Was it Sly Stallone? Biggest income producer for a movie? Millions and millions of dollars for one movie is what he gets for one movie. More than any of us, more than all of us combined will see in a lifetime, you know, he gets for one movie. I think another theme of American culture is that kind of you only go around once. Get yours while you can. Put a little gusto into your life. Do it now. All of that kind of stuff. Fast food. I think, you know, it's America is in a hurry. Where is it going? You know, what is the big hurry? You know, one of the larger changes, I think, in my lifetime that I've seen in American culture is expressways and fast food restaurants. I mean, when I grew up, my dad worked in a steel mill, and he carried his lunch in a lunch bucket. And when I worked in that mill, I carried my lunch in a lunch bucket. I don't know what they do in that mill these days, but there weren't McDonald's. There were a few places, but there weren't very many. And a Dairy Queen was a very big deal when it opened. But what kind of hurry is everybody in? And the money that's spent. I think, if I remember correctly, McDonald's U.S., not counting the one in Russia and China, everywhere else. McDonald's U.S. grossed $12 billion in 1988. $12 billion in 1988. The WIC program, the Women, Infants, and Children Supplemental Food Program, cost 2.5 billion dollars in 1989. Americans are perfectly willing to spend $12 billion at McDonald's, but very reluctant to fund a nutrition program for pregnant women and infants. It tells you something about the profound sickness in our culture. We are a very, very sick culture. I believe that for a long time and still do, in spite of all the rah-rahs and sis-boom-bahs. Domino's Pizza, I mean, it's a good pizza. It's relatively nutritious, as pizza goes, nutritionists say. I heard on the car radio that something like 20 Domino's pizza drivers got killed in traffic accidents last year. Well, you know, on the whole scheme of things, 20 people's not very many. But if it's your son or daughter, you know, who gets killed out there because people have to have their pizza in 30 minutes or less, there's something very, very wrong about that. There's something very seriously wrong about that. What are some of the rituals? Those are some of the themes or myths of American culture. I think health is another one. Health culture. We jog, we use olive oil, we eat tofu, we take over-the-counter medication. I read a story in the Washington Post about people who jog so much. And I think, you know, exercise is good for you. I'm not putting exercise down. But what accounts for people who jog so much that they come into doctor's office with bandaged feet? They're told that they should not jog for a while, and they break down and cry. There's something, there's a kind of fixation there. There's a kind of, and again, I think it's death denial. I think it's death denial. What are some of the rites and rituals of American culture? I think going to the mall. Going to the mall has replaced going to church or almost anywhere else for people, apparently. I was kind of slow picking up on this. But apparently a lot of people, you know, it's Friday night, what do we do? Let's go to the mall. So that, you know, that the mall becomes a major place for social functions. And it's kind of interesting because a mall is an anonymous kind of place. That is to say, it's not like getting together with family, you know, where you have a sort of intimacy of some kind. But it's a place where you can go and do things. You can buy, go to movies, you can eat out. But you don't have to interact very much with real people. I mean, you don't have to, I mean, they're real people, but you don't have to engage them as fully real. I was in a mall not too long ago where they had set up a display of wedding stuff, wedding paraphernalia. So there were dresses. I mean, they had the whole center of the mall. They had wedding dresses. They had invitations. They had, I don't know, whatever else, catering, whatever else you need for a wedding. And they had all these booths and all these things. Now, it's kind of interesting, you know, that people would go to the mall to constitute that kind of major event in your family life. So malls, I think, the business of America is business. It is harder and harder in some parts of the country to tell the bank from the church. I think another ritual of Americans, and a good one, I think, is family at holidays. Not all rituals of Americans are bad. Small community, gatherings, family reunions. Although one wonders how long that's going to hold. I went to a high school reunion, finally, my first ever, and talked to a guy I went to high school with. He said, you know, my father worked here, I worked here, but my sons won't. And I think that's, I don't know, but we are so mobile. The people I find most unwilling to move in our culture are Hispanic Americans who have a sense of rootedness and family and community, who just, when we go looking for people for jobs, the positions that we have, the people who won't move 90 miles down the road for a job, 90 miles, let alone across the continent, tend to be, for the most part, Hispanic Americans. That's just a tendency. It's not absolutely true in any case. Another one of the rituals of American culture is going out, going to the movies, going to the restaurant. I don't have those figures with me anymore, but it's interesting. Look up in Statistical Abstract what Americans spend on restaurants and movies. It is an incredible dollar figure. These dollar figures and some of this stuff make the federal budget not look so bad, frankly. I mean, it is bad, but it's just that we're not used to dealing in those large units. I mean, if McDonald's, the federal budget's, what, $300 billion? No, that's not it. That's the military budget. $285. I don't know what they finally approved, $285.9 or something like that. Federal budget's $1 trillion. That's, you know, the gross income of several of the largest corporations. I mean, it's a lot of money. But when you look at the money that is needlessly spent, it doesn't look nearly so bad. And yes, we spend a lot of money on welfare and things like that. But if you start comparing it with other things, it begins relatively not to look like such a bad investment. Somehow, another of our major rituals is sports, and I don't know whether, I guess this is good, or maybe it's bad, I don't even know. But it's amazing to me. I lived in Texas for 17 years, and it's just amazing to me how you can fill an arena for football games. How when the Dallas Cowboys were in the Super Bowl, you could walk the streets of Fort Worth naked and nobody would see you, because everybody was watching television. I mean, it just, the whole, everything, phew, Everybody was inside. And you could tell when it came halftime, because all of a sudden all these cars had rushed to the 7-Eleven for whatever, chips or milk or beer or whatever people were getting. But there's that winning and losing mentality, winning and losing, right and wrong, the Cowboys versus the Steelers, the Contras versus the Sandinistas, the righteous versus the evil empire. There's something about that collapses nuance and deals only in stereotype. Well, we could go on a bit, but I think the marketplace, the mall, and the movie house are three of our most important sacred places. That is to say, what do I mean by that? They are places where people go to experience a reality beyond themselves. They go to movies, they go to the mall, and they go to the marketplace. I mean, the marketplace and the mall somewhat overlap, but business, there are a lot of business outside of malls. I think those are the places where people go for meaning, where they go for satisfaction, where they go for nurturance, where they go for escape, where they go for to somehow get through the day or get through the week or make themselves feel good. Find spiritual regeneration at movies. And so in a sense they function as religious places in American culture. I don't know. But because the, I think at least, because the church is so heavily a part of American culture, it becomes, and that's good and bad, I mean, the gospel is always enculturated. It's always enculturated. There is no gospel apart from culture. There was no gospel, there's no New Testament apart from its culture. There's no gospel today apart from its culture. So it's inevitable, but what that means is then that it's sometimes very, very hard to tell what is the gospel and what is the culture. How do you sort one out from the other? When even in ministry or in seminary teaching, it begins to be how many books did you publish, or, and then there's a hierarchy, a ranking, and it begins to look just like a business. Or in ministry, you know, how big a church do you have, how much money, you know, how many people did you take in, how much money did you take in. It begins to be, have very little to do with the good news. It seems to me, at least, and has a lot to do with American culture. You know, what is the good news? The good news, what is the good news? If you are hungry, the good news is a slice of bread, period. If you are thirsty, the good news is a drink of water. You know, if you are sick, the good news is, you know, maybe a surgeon if you need surgery. If you are any kind of human, the good news is another human who cares about you. That's what the good news really is for us at a very, very basic level. And that comes to us through the church, but it comes so mixed with the culture that it's very hard to tell, to sort the two out, I think. Well, I kind of went on preaching here a bit longer than I wanted to, but I wanted to talk about, to get down to, you can make a difference. And in that context, if you haven't seen it, I wanted you to see this videotape about a way in which at least some of us, some people, including some of you who are involved with the Bread for the World, try to bring good news through the political process, make a difference through involvement in the political process.
Out there, but I didn't really understand what the causes were. And I certainly didn't understand what some of the solutions could be.
The fact that we are working together as Christian brothers and sisters across a very broad range of denominations has a special appeal to me.
No one person can do anything. But when you join together and put your expertise together, then that's when you become effective. It was always so lonely to feel like am I the only person that's really concerned about these issues. And I could come to a bread meeting and find out, no, other people are concerned. This is something that other people are working about. It was a real shot in the arm.
Bread for the World is a nonpartisan Christian citizens movement against hunger. Since 1974, Bread for the World has been mobilizing individuals and churches to lobby for legislation that helps hungry people at home and around the world.
We thank you for this group of people here tonight.
Here in Atlanta, as in some 400 local chapters across the country, Bread members join together to discuss strategies.
In the story of the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus says, you give them something to eat. That's a sentence that's very powerful, speaks to my mission and my understanding and my calling into the Christian life. And we in America are so richly blessed.
It was not just a matter of feeding the hungry person, it's a matter of changing the systems that create hunger. And I see this as an approach to bring about that kind of change.
Nutrition programs can be sold as something that saves us tax dollars. Every dollar spent on the WIC program has been shown to save $3 in health care costs for premature infants and their mothers. And so it's marketable.
The basic thing is that you can change things. You can save lives. You can feed hungry people by just writing letters or making phone calls or helping your organization any way you can. And the best part about it is they tell you how.
I say everyone counts. And oftentimes you underestimate the value that one person can bring. Sometimes all it takes is one person to be a catalyst for something. And even though the problem may seem enormous, everything has to start somewhere.
We live in a democracy, and we have an opportunity to make life better for other people. We are part of the government. We can raise our voice on behalf of hungry people. And if we do that, we can make a difference. Public policy has an enormous effect in determining whether people eat or die.
And I believe there was a meeting with Tribble down in
One of the fundamental ways Bread for the World members participate is through writing personal letters to Congress.
Maybe another way to address it, too, is to focus on the hunger aspect in relation to...
Writing a letter really takes so little effort. The hardest part is overcoming the initial inertia. And in a group like this, you really have the incentive to get the job done, and it's very gratifying.
So why don't we just take a few minutes? We are going to run a few minutes past 9. Take a few minutes and just write a brief letter. And then we can send them out tonight.
When I write a letter, I feel like I'm having influence, and that, from a selfish point of view, perhaps makes me feel good. I think also the act of writing a letter sort of commits you personally to a particular piece of legislation. You become interested in it, you begin to watch it, you watch its progress or lack thereof.
One legislator told us that if they get 10 letters on a particular issue, that automatically puts a staff aide to work on that issue, no matter what the issue is.
I feel that even if I write a letter to Congress and the issue doesn't pass, I still feel like I've made a difference. I feel like I've raised awareness about the issue, and I know that I did my best and I learned more about the issue in the process.
Bread for the World also coordinates letter writing campaigns at churches nationwide in an annual offering of letters supporting specific pieces of legislation.
I know that so many times when I've heard about world hunger and disease, I have felt helpless as an individual to do anything about these problems. And that's something that's wonderful about what we're doing today, because we have the chance as citizens to write our representatives and let them know that we're concerned about children's health in other countries, not just in our own. And we have the chance to affect the policy making in our country through expressing our opinions.
Bread for the World demonstrated the power of letter writing with its campaign on the Child Survival Fund, which contributes to the international effort to save the lives of children from hunger-related diseases.
We have policy analysts on staff who developed the legislation for child survival. Went in as a proposal as part of the foreign aid package back in 1984. The letters went into Congress on child survival, and Congress did establish that fund and voted an initial $25 million for it. We had asked for 50, we got 25. Well, that's half a loaf, and that's the way you make progress.
Over the next few years, BREAD helped increase the level of funding to $100 million.
Now, the key question is, what does $100 million mean in terms of real live human beings? Well, when we first proposed the legislation, Jim Grant, the director of UNICEF, told me that for every $100 spent on child survival, they estimate that at least one child's life is saved. If you apply that formula to the $100 million that Congress voted for fiscal year 1989, you're talking about 1 million kids who will live rather than die just from 1 year's funding alone. That's 25 children for every Bread for the World member.
Children have a right to survive, to grow in health, and to be protected and nurtured in their growth to full potential. And you and the Bread for the World, on this front, as well as many other fronts, are contributing to making a real difference. Keep up your work, and thank you.
Of every 1,000 children in the fifth grade, 302 would graduate from high school and 118 would enter college. Of every 1,000, 302 would graduate from high school and 118 would enter college. That's a little over 10% would enter college and about 30% would graduate from high school.
What year is that?
1924-25. By 1962, why 62? Because these are the figures I happen to find in the statistical abstract. You know, I'd like to find 92, or 82, rather. By 1962, 752 would graduate and 465 would enter college. That's to say, 75% would graduate from high school and almost 50% would enter college. I have four children. One is black, two are women. 130 years ago, slavery was legal in this country. 130 years is not very long in the scheme of things. 25 years ago, Texas Christian University, where I taught, was still segregated. 70 years ago, my two daughters would not have been able to vote, except in some states, some individual states had permitted voting. And if you couldn't vote, you generally couldn't serve on juries either, because a lot of jury pools were drawn from the registered voter pool. 70 years is not so long. Lots of people alive now who were alive when women could not vote. Why did those things happen? Because suffragettes worked for all those years because people hunkered down and worked on school boards. I mean, something as prosaic as a school board, you know, because people voted for taxes, for better schools, because people worked against slavery, some making great sacrifices, some making little, some sacrificing their lives, others sacrificing just their time and energy. But the point of all of that is that, or look at the Berlin thing, and I mean the Germany thing in the last year. Some people, I mean, yeah, it all kind of happened in 1 year, but it didn't happen out of nowhere. People were working on that thing, you know, ever since World War II. Some people have been working on that. And yeah, it took all those years for it to happen, but by golly, it happened. Look how long it took us to get out of Vietnam. I mean, a lot of people put a lot of time and money and energy, you know, all those demonstrations and stuff, and all the money and education that went on. It took a long time, a lot of deaths. But we did get out. So, you know, while at the moment what you're looking at is Vietnam War, Berlin Wall, you know, high school dropouts, I continue to believe that in a longer term frame of reference, that we can make a difference. We have both the ability and the resources to restore the environment, to eradicate hunger, to bring a lot of major diseases under control, though granted, death is still going to be death. To have a lot safer environment. I also, in statistics, looked up, I don't have it with me, but mining accidents and industrial accidents and just a whole bunch of things that you could track over the last 100 years. Why? Again, not because some bolt of lightning came out of the sky or because the snow fell one morning, but because people, day by day, hunkered down and just ground that stuff out. And in the middle of it, it's a drag. But what I've been trying to say this weekend is that this political work is a spiritual work, because it increases the reign of God's Spirit. It increases, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. The only way it gets done is when we do it. In one sense, God has no hands, but in that song, no hands but our hands. I mean, it sounds crude and crass, but God can't even make a pizza without us. And that sounds terribly crude, I know it does, and offensive probably. But the sum of the God in us, of the God in me, working with the God in you and the God in you and you and you, you know, is the way in which those things happen. And therefore, I'm confident. I have faith. I have hope. I experience love in this justice work. So, I didn't mean to talk for the whole time. Do you have anything you want to say in response, or to either the first story, the Mayan myth, or the comments on American culture? As defines us, the point of where was that American culture tends to be our reference group rather than the gospel or the religious message.
Were you... in your talk on American myths and American rituals and sacred places and so forth, was that written in a paper that you...
Hey, it was something I started once and have never gotten around to doing anything with, yeah. There's a little more than I gave you. I skipped some things, too.
I'd love to have a copy of that. We could run it through the toaster.
Yeah, I have pieces of it here, yeah.
When you were talking... earlier about that, I realized how deeply planted psychically those values become, so that even though one can intellectually dissuade oneself, you still get hooked by them.
I live in a social justice community, bred for the world, you know, and yet I'm still governed by a lot of that stuff. I mean,
sure, how many people can you How much money can you generate?
Right. I have...
how successful can the organization
be? Right, right. Stuff runs very deep. Yeah. Even, and I'm fortunate to be in a community where I'm continually reminded of that, you know. Mm-hmm. Think of where that leaves the average person who's working in business somewhere, you know. And it's tough. It's tough. That stuff is very deep. I don't think we ever get entire handles on it. Sort of like racism and sexism and things like that. I think that we get relative handles on it, but never absolute handles on it. We never are fully culturally transcendent. At least most of us aren't. Maybe some people are.
I wonder how you ever... Well, I suppose, you know, breaking free from some of those images is... how do you do that? How does the society do that?
Well, partly you need reference groups that are, in the broadest sense, and not just in the 1960s sense, countercultural. You need people in terms of whom you can define your reality, who themselves are faithful to a different drummer, if you will. You need reinforcement. Because it's so deep, and because I find myself so easily slipping all the time. I mean, my life is one big slide, just right down the hill. I need people around me.
To remind you.
To remind me.
Yeah.
Because they'll remember this, and I'll remember that, and we can help each other, you know? It's very tough at the macro level to... what we need partly is, you know, they said you can't legislate morality. The heck you can't. You can't legislate what's in people's minds entirely. But part of it is changing the basic structures of society to reflect a more just ordering of things. Personally, I mean, I have some personal opinions about that, but they wouldn't be necessarily great for the world opinions. I think we should, we have a more socialized medicine, more socialized legal system. I mean, you've, I guess, lived with one in Norway, and you know more about how that works than I do. But Canadians seem to be fairly happy with their system, relatively happy with their system, and it's sure a whole lot more socialized than ours. At least I stayed with a stockbroker. I thought if anybody would criticize it, it'd be a stockbroker. And he said, that's a great system. Where wealth does not define, is not a primary definer of the quality of life.